Two studies out today that draw the same disturbing conclusion. Americans are not winning their battle against obesity. One study found that obesity rates for adults actually...
Obesity. It seems like it should be easy to treat. Calories in, calories out, simple. But it's actually incredibly difficult. And that goes both for the people who are trying to slim down and the drug makers who have struggled to find treatments to help. Welcome to Prognosis, a podcast about health, medical technology, and the mind-blowing innovation underway across the globe. I'm your host, Michelle Faye Cortez. More than 700 million people around the world are considered obese. If you're 5'8" tall and weigh more than 200 pounds, that's obese. If you're shorter, say 5'4" and more than 175 pounds, that's also obese. It's about much more than how you look. It increases the risk of diabetes, heart disease, and cancer. And it's expensive. The health costs in the U.S. alone top $150 billion a year. If drug makers could find a way to help people achieve safe and significant weight loss, it would spur profound benefits, not to mention profits. It hasn't happened yet. Every few years, there is a new hyped drug that seems to show up with outsized expectations, but they've generally turned out to be disappointments. Some believe that's about to change. Most people who succeed in losing weight quickly gain it right back. Our bodies are programmed to do that. Now a promising new approach in the lab aims to both suppress appetite and switch off the signal that tells your slimmed down body to conserve energy. That may be just the key to keeping those pounds off. Here's Bloomberg's James Payton with the story.
To understand the obesity crisis today, we need to start with some history. Ancient history, like all the way back to the Stone Age history. So let's rewind tens of thousands of years. Humans are hunters and gatherers, and in order to survive the cycles of feast and famine, they needed to consume extra calories and hold on to them. Mads Krogsgaard Thomsen, the chief science officer at Novo Nordisk, the Danish drug company, puts it like this.
So we would simply have a situation where in the one half of the year, we would be really good at putting on a lot of weight by eating a lot of food. And then in the other half, the cold half of the year, where the buffalo were no longer there to be hunted and there were no vegetables and so on, we would have a situation where people would typically go into their caves and basically just try to survive, quite honestly, and burn off as little energy as possible so that they were still alive when the next spring would arise.
So those who were best at conserving energy and storing fat endured the harsh winters and went on to reproduce. Those famine-beating genes are a problem for us today. Mad says our unhealthy habits, combined with our genetic tendency to hang on to calories, add up to a double whammy of weight gain.
Nowadays, we are living in a constant feast situation. We're eating, and we're not exercising much. So those very genes that were good for our survival, that made those people survive with longer lives and have more babies in the old days because they were good at preserving energy and building fat stores in their bodies, they are now at risk of obesity, type 2 diabetes, and other conditions.
So that's where we are now. Our ancestors relied on storing fat to survive, but our current lifestyle blows that out of proportion. It took society a while to realize what was happening, though. It's only within the last few decades that scientists have come to understand the biology behind obesity.
Years ago, an increase in body weight or obesity wasn't considered to be a disease. We really didn't understand anything about weight-regulating mechanisms. It was thought to be purely a disorder of willpower, that people with obesity were lazy, they couldn't control themselves, and therefore it wasn't something that was worthy of being treated by a physician. Another important point is that the relationship between obesity and other illnesses like diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, sleep disorders was not understood at all.
That's Louis Aroney, a doctor and obesity specialist at Weill Cornell Medicine in New York. He started a weight control center there in 1986. Now, groups such as the American Medical Association classify obesity as a disease, And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention acknowledge that genes are a factor based on the different ways people respond to an environment of high-calorie food. Although obesity is still often seen as a self-inflicted condition, there's a growing realization that its causes are more complex. Lewis is especially fascinated by how hard it is for people to lose weight and keep it off. He suspects that's because consuming too much fatty food can damage the nerves that tell the brain how much fat is stored. Faulty signals can trick the body into erroneously storing unnecessary amounts. That explains why trying to shed pounds can be agonizing for some patients.
It's very frustrating for people trying to lose weight. And I would challenge anyone who doesn't think so to try to lose weight. You get hungry. You think about food. You may wake up in the middle of the night thinking about food. And in the past, people thought they were going crazy, that there was something wrong with them. But now we know it's the result of these physical changes in signaling that caused this to occur.
6 years ago, not a single state in the U.S. had an adult obesity rate above 35%. That's according to the CDC. Recent data show that 7 states have since moved into that danger zone. One is Louisiana, where there's abundant fatty food, a lack of physical activity, and all the other usual culprits. And now, more regions around the globe are starting to look like Louisiana. Eric Ravison is an obesity expert who works at Pennington Biomedical Research Center in Baton Rouge, the state's capital. Despite the warnings, he says many people simply don't comprehend the gravity of the situation.
It's like global warming, you know. What does it take to be concerned? I mean, it takes these climate disasters and all that. And we're going to face the same when it comes to public health.
Eric is a former researcher at pharma company Eli Lilly. And so he's well aware of the industry's long battle against the condition. It's been a humbling experience for many of the people pursuing a solution.
The whole treatment of obesity has been very disappointing. And this has been a train wreck of failures. And it started, you know, in the 1930s.
Early products to tackle obesity included laxatives, thyroid hormones, amphetamines, and other drugs that came with severe side effects. Similar approaches continued through the 1960s. Many of these products were pulled from the market. Then, in the 1990s, researchers thought they had finally found an answer. It was called Fen-Phen, a weight loss treatment that combined fenfluramine, a 1970s-era diet drug, with phentermine, an appetite suppressant. The treatment became a huge success. But the frenzy soon turned into a fiasco.
Very early, we discovered that fenfluramine was causing heart valve problems, and this was also withdrawn from the market. Personally, I went to Eli Lilly in the 90s, late 90s, to work on obesity drugs. And at that time, there is a real hope that new drugs were going to target very specific receptors and being very efficacious. But it didn't pan out.
A high point that same decade was the discovery of leptin, a hormone tied to hunger. When people add fat, leptin levels increase, telling the brain that the body has had enough to eat. But leptin also failed to live up to expectations when researchers found that many obese people were resistant to its effects. Several more dead ends followed. So why do scientists and pharma companies keep trying? Quite simply, because an effective weight loss drug would be among the holy grail of meds, right up there with treatments for cholesterol and arthritis. Novo's focus on a weight loss treatment dates back to the 1990s.
So slightly more than 20 years ago, we had a very philosophical discussion in the management of the company whether obesity was a disease or a lifestyle-driven condition. And we actually came to the conclusion that it was not only a chronic disease that was genetically predisposed, it was also the precursor stage to diabetes.
Lately, the focus is on a hormone that plays a role in regulating blood sugar and body weight. It's called glucagon-like peptide, or GLP-1, and it was first used to treat diabetes. Novo is now repurposing its new diabetes drugs and relying on a synthetic version of the hormone to mimic what's produced naturally in the body. This work is at the core of the company's strategy to develop a more effective obesity treatment. The company developed an injectable GLP-1 drug called Saxenda, designed to make you feel less hungry. It's one of several available today that deliver weight loss in the 5 to 10% range. But these drugs are expensive, and the results tend to stall after several months, prompting some patients to stop taking them. Many insurers, employers, and governments are reluctant to cover the cost. So Novo is pushing the boundaries. Its researchers are testing a next-generation drug in the same class, with hopes of getting closer to delivering 15% weight loss. That's considered a kind of magical level that drug companies figure they need to reach to really open up the market. The company has just started a late-stage trial to evaluate the treatment's heart benefits in more than 17,000 people. It's the largest study in the company's history. Now, if Novo can show the medicine extends lives, reducing heart attacks and strokes on top of slashing weight, it will no doubt bolster the case for the drug and help the company win over skeptics. But that would be just step one. Novo has bigger plans in mind. It's betting on combinations of complementary hormones to try to create a super drug that will overcome the body's tendency to put the pounds back on after weight loss. Or in other words, fight our caveman-like tendencies. It's a radical approach and ambitious. Weight loss north of 20% or even more. To get there, Novo scientists will have to attain results comparable to gastric bypass and other weight loss surgeries. But the idea is that the treatments won't have the risks and complications such as blood clots and infections that can occur with those major operations. Novo has been able to extend the impact of an appetite-regulating hormone called amylin by boosting its half-life. It was just a few minutes. Now it's about 1 week. Early studies suggest that increasing the amount of time it circulates in the body could enable weight loss of roughly 1% every 7 days.
And the good news is that this is an effect that seems to be additive to what we know for GLP-1. So if you actually add the two compounds together, you get twice as much efficacy, twice as much bang for the buck, so to speak. And this is often what human beings need, because if you don't deal the system a 1-2 blow, so to speak, then there will be compensatory mechanisms that are kicking in to try to regain the body weight. So we believe, to a very large extent, that combination therapies will be a good way forward for people with severe obesity.
Mads's team is working hard to come up with drug combinations that boost the amount of energy the body burns while at the same time suppressing appetite. That takes us to mitochondria. Mitochondria, you may recall from your high school biology class, are those tiny structures inside cells that, among other things, convert sugars into energy. Novo researchers are looking at ways to stimulate energy expenditure in a way that doesn't affect heart rate and blood pressure, a feat that others have tried but failed to pull off safely. Eric, the researcher in Louisiana, recognizes how beneficial that could be. He's studied contestants from the reality TV show The Biggest Loser.
Previously on The Biggest Loser, at the weigh-in, the red and blue teams had disappointing numbers.
We have to reassess what is going on because something's got to change.
Jay lost an astonishing 12 pounds.
The contestants' metabolism slowed dramatically after shedding significant amounts of weight, and many of The Biggest Losers regained a lot of the weight they had dropped. Eric realized the importance of somehow keeping energy expenditure up after someone sheds pounds.
Let's say you lose 10% of your weight, you have a decrease in your resting metabolic rate, which is going to be more than 10%. We did studies in The Biggest Loser who lose up to half of their body weight, and these people become tremendously energy efficient. In other words, they have a very, very low metabolic rate. And I believe that in a first phase of treatment, an appetite suppression drug is the most adequate way to go. But after reaching a plateau, let's say 5, 10, or even 15% weight loss, you need to introduce something else which is going to boost up your energy metabolism.
One mixture of drugs won't work for everyone, and scientists are seeking to understand why. Eric is optimistic they will thread the needle.
I have heard many times, you know, within 10 years, we'll have this magic pill or whatever. And now I'm wise enough not to say that, but I know we are making progress. And these progress are important. And I think that eventually, yes, we will be more successful in treating people.
Novo isn't the only entity trying to better understand that rate at which the body converts food to energy. Scientists at a number of universities are finding answers that reside inside the brain. Rachel Lippert was previously involved in studies in mice at Vanderbilt and the University of Michigan. She studied the function of a brain protein called MC3R and how it helps balance the amount of energy we take in and use. The workings of MC3R have long baffled scientists, and a better understanding of the protein may open up a new path toward obesity drugs. Rachel now works at the Max Planck Institute for Metabolism Research in Germany. She says epigenetics, the study of how genes are turned on or off by factors in the environment, are also providing new clues.
There's so many layers of complexity that have been discovered recently because of all of the advancement in genetic tools that we have in the basic research laboratories. That is really just kind of, it's like peeling back layers of an onion in terms of the levels of complexity that we deal with in the basic research.
Because obesity leads to so many other serious diseases, the potential impact from an ultra-effective drug could have a big ripple effect on patients and help governments all over the world deal with the obesity crisis.
So just imagine that. You take the medicine, you lose the weight, and you don't have to take something for your prediabetes or your blood pressure or your cholesterol, and your sleep disorder gets better. You know, that is the promise of obesity treatment. I joke around with our younger doctors and tell them it's like one of those late night infomercials where you get the miracle knives and you get the fryer and you get everything thrown into one when you treat the obesity. You get all the health benefits.
Still, there are plenty of naysayers out there. They say the focus should be on preventing obesity, not treating it. And they question whether drugs should be part of the strategy at all. Others want to tax products such as sodas to really make a difference. Lewis says he's even gotten pushback from some of his own colleagues.
As many resources as we can, we should apply to preventing obesity. But the fact is that once obesity is established, using strategies to prevent obesity don't work. They're not enough. It's kind of like someone's diagnosed with lung cancer, and you tell them, okay, you have lung cancer now, and your treatment's going to be to stop smoking, right? That sounds absurd. But trying to prevent the disease once it's established doesn't usually work as a therapy because something physical has changed.
For now, few doctors and patients are relying on medicines to treat obesity. Diet, exercise, and other changes are vital. But if those measures don't work, some people should be treated with drugs before their situation gets worse, before they develop diabetes and other complications. That's the view of experts, including Lewis. He believes more patients will get drugs in the future as the science and awareness among physicians accelerates. An obesity board set up 7 years ago in the U.S. certified more than 600 doctors in the past year, he says. That's comparable to the branch of medicine focused on the digestive system and its disorders. So these drugs are playing a limited role right now. Are we at any kind of turning point, do you think, when it comes to the treatment of obesity with medicine?
I can't tell you when the turning point will come where there's widespread adoption of medical therapies for obesity, but I strongly believe that it is coming. And I'm not sure we're going to be able to change the course of the obesity epidemic and the health complications through behavioral management alone.
While it's hard to know when that might happen, researchers at least have a roadmap. 2 decades ago, Mad says, type 2 diabetes was as misunderstood as obesity is today. But that changed when scientists showed controlling blood sugar levels would extend lives and lower heart and stroke risks.
I do believe that we are now standing at the inflection point where obesity in the next few years to come will undergo the same, you can say, metamorphosis from being considered a lifestyle disorder to being considered a serious chronic disease. And part of that job is for us to do the studies I'm discussing and proving to society, just like we did with diabetes 20 years ago, that this is the case. And that will then drive rational uptake of new therapies in that marketplace, giving people a healthier and a longer life, we hope.
It's a new era for obesity drugs. Novo is developing treatments that act like natural hormones to try to avoid the bad side effects seen in the medicines of the past that affected the central nervous system. The company is also learning more about the hormones that allow the stomach and the brain to talk to each other, what he calls the gut-brain axis.
I think combinations of these mediators that exist in the so-called dialogue between the gut and the brain, they will be very important to investigate, and also the ability to co-administer them so that you actually get maybe one, maybe two, or maybe even three signals that either signal satiety or increase the energy expenditure.
Mad says sometime in the distant future, we may evolve in a different way and become better at burning off energy and consuming less. For now, Novo wants to help patients fight their inner caveman.
I'm quite optimistic that 10 years from now, if people are actually treated, they will have longer and better lives. And this is not wishful thinking. This is based on clinical evidence that we're creating as we speak.
And that's it for this week's Prognosis. Thanks for listening. Do you have a story about healthcare in the U.S. or around the world? We want to hear from you. You can email me at mcortez@bloomberg.net or find me on Twitter at @theycortez. If you are a fan of this episode, please take a moment to rate and review us. It helps new listeners find the show. This episode was produced by Lindsay Cradawill. Our story editor was Rick Schein. Thanks also to Drew Armstrong. Francesca Levy is head of Bloomberg Podcasts. We'll see you next week.